The actual underpinning of this is globalization. This is like all of these things came out of a market economy that was felt safe and assured because of globalization. We had cheap, we were importing deflation from China and our clothes are getting cheaper and, you know, and our oil was fairly good. And, you know, we can, you know, we can add more leverage personally as a company, as a nation, as a state. But that only works when things, when the ship is sailing nicely and it's calm weather.
Hello, everyone. Chris Martinson here. I am very excited to be talking today with Stephen Flood of Goldcore. As you know, Goldcore is a company that we do business with and we really love because of their solutions for helping people have access to really highly secure distributed gold and silver storage. So, Stephen, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's great to be here, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
All things, you know, if this is the funny thing to talk about gold, which, you know, we can talk about your exactly how people would go about that. But there's so many reasons now. But the thesis for gold often means you have to. Well, I've been examining this thing called the Great Taking. So this is sort of a legal framework that's a little dodgy, maybe, and a lot there to unpack. But also geopolitics. Sometimes you have to be aware of gold is gold is gold. It is the only other sort of financial asset I'm aware of that Basel has just declared a tier one asset that isn't somebody else's liability. It's got really interesting characteristics. And so this is important, and it relates to the geopolitics, which we'll get into. People ask me, I was just at this conference. A lot of people said, well, come on, why you old gold? You know, you can feel the barbarous relic, shiny rock thing sort of lurking there. You know, how about exciting Bitcoin or some NVIDIA or something? And I said, you know, those things, as exciting as they are, gold has something else, which it has a call option embedded in it most people don't know about, which is that there's a chance. I'm not saying it's a big chance, but it has a chance of being called as becoming backing for currency again somewhere out there. And that call option, I think, is not appropriately valued yet. If it were, gold would be much higher in price. So that's one of the reasons I'm holding it right now. What do you think of that thought?
Oh, listen, I'm all there. I mean, I think it's so cheap. I don't want to sound like a cheesy salesman and tell you it's cheap, you have to buy it. I mean, you have to look at it from your own perspective and your portfolio. But I just look, if you look at historical patterns and where it's been and how important it is and the fact that it's still really important, even in the age of technology with all of the wonders that we're surrounded by, this inanimate object, this shiny thing that just sits there, it doesn't do anything really. Like, it is, you know, it has applications in technology, but for the most part, it's shiny and it sits in vaults. Why is that? It has this, it's captured the human mind, you know, like nothing else. And so I do think from my perspective and from many people we talk to, our clients, it's a contingency asset. It's a special type of asset which is value, comes into its own when contingent risks happen, when black swans appear, when what we thought was going to be turns out not to be the case because the data was wrong, we were lied to, we were naive in some way, we elected the wrong people, whatever the reason is, whenever we're caught out, gold is your friend. It's there, and it's just, and its value should adjust and thereby take the sting out of a correction that might be affecting you and your family and your community in other ways. So it takes the sting out of the correction, and then it gives you options. It gives you the chance to breathe, to think about what your plan is going to be, because you're not going to be prepared in every situation, but it does buy you some time. And I think as an investor, go for Bitcoin, go for NVIDIA, go for any of these stocks. You know, do creative things with your money. Invest in really great businesses and people and education. But have that backup plan, because gold is valued throughout time and all cultures, everywhere in the world. I mean, you may not speak Mandarin, but I can guarantee you the man on the other side of the deal who does will agree a price with you for your gold, or you can agree a price for his gold. And that is the one place where all economies, all people, they all meet clearly throughout time. I mean, like, it's unbelievable. There's no asset like it. So it's very rare. It can't be printed. And one other factor, I'm often quoted saying this, is that it gives you, the individual, personal sovereignty, financial sovereignty. And that means that you are in command of that piece of money, that piece of wealth, because they can't print it. They can ban what they can't find. And whatever you have, or wherever you have it stored in a vault in Switzerland, in your back garden, you know, wherever it might be, it gives you that value and gives you that protection. So I think it's an incredible time to own it. You know, I think people should accumulate it. And I think if you look at what's happening in the world and the machinations out there, you know, these are not the most certain of times. And that's putting it mildly. And so I do think as an individual, you know, start, even if you're a student, start with $100 worth of gold, buy something, make it a part of your investment psyche.
I agree. So talking about printing, United States being the world's reserve currency has a special role and a duty and an obligation to safeguard that for everybody's benefit, including our own. I'll be generous and say my country's flailing about a little bit right now on a number of fronts. And pick them, right? Sending hundreds of billions off to get blown up somewhere, not having an actual border and letting in millions, if not tens of millions of people over time that are going to require, are going to be a net drain before they're a net positive, just because of the dynamics of having to get resettled and all the help and all that's going to have to happen at best. And then, but mostly, the CBO is now my new Stephen King novelist, right? When they come out and they're telling me about how, like, Stephen, from here to 2035, we're going to be running more an average of little over $2 trillion a year deficits. That's without a recession. That's no extra spending. That's no, like, you know, they get a little scared or it's in whatever. Okay, we're that two times 10 is 20 plus 34. We're at 53, 55 trillion by 2035. And they're just going to have to keep printing that up. So...
yeah,
doesn't, I mean, feel like, responsible to me.
No, it's a Ponzi scheme. I mean, I hate to tell you, it is a Ponzi scheme because you're printing money to pay for the previous money that you printed and your bills of today. You'd never run a company, a household. You'd be bankrupt. You'd be laughed out of town if anybody turned up and made an investment case for this charade. They would be sent off to the insane asylum. They'd be medicated. You know, really. I mean, I don't understand it. It's why they've gone this way. I know. Exorbitant privilege that the dollar is in the world, but that dollar privilege is now being eroded at an unbelievable rate. Countries are saying, well, you know, we liked your dollar before for trade purposes. It brought a degree of stability for ourselves, and it was great. You guys were able to issue debt really cheap, and that's great too. And you buy our goods and services. Fantastic. It's a happy arrangement. But when they politicize the dollar, and, you know, I'm sure it's not popular to say, but like Putin actually said this with Tucker Carlson, I think, and he talked about the fact that the decision to politicize the dollar and to ban it and to take possession of reserves, central bank reserves, and even in some cases, central bank gold, you know, what they did was they basically, you know, stuck a knife through the heart of globalization. And now what we have is retrenchment all over the world. Every single economy, finance minister, secretary of the Treasury is now looking to create a moat, some sort of protective economic layer to protect and insulate their economy. They're nearshoring. This is a term that Janet Yellen came up with. They are looking to only deal with very, very, very close friend economies. And this has really changed the whole world dynamic now. So if you're in China's orbit, and you're in the Asia Pacific, you know, if you look forward 10 years, who's your friend? Is it the United States with an uncertain political situation and, you know, with different making all sorts of statements and coming out of, you know, from Trump saying, you know, he's not happy with NATO, blah blah blah. Who are you going to actually start to deal with? I mean, probably more likely China. So this is all changing. What happens to Australia in that situation? Like, who do they turn to? It's I think it's all up for the taking. I don't know why they politicized the dollar. I think it was the one and only thing that kept this system, which was very debt induced, and quite unstable anyway. and they've literally killed it now. It's dead on arrival, really, now at this stage. So yeah, so we're in a very, very changed time, and I think that, again, I know I don't want to sound like I'm talking our own book here, but the case for gold for the individual, for the company, you know, if you're a company and you've got extra reserves sitting there in a bank, and they're being eroded with an enormous inflation hit, which is going to continue for many years to come, because that is an effect of the 34 trillion in debt and going to 50. That creates inflation. And you know, you have money sitting there in a bank, and you talked about the great taking and what that means. In fact, you don't actually have that money. You're a creditor. So I think having gold in a vault in Switzerland, you know, makes a lot of sense.
An unsecured creditor, which is the worst kind.
Yeah. Well, they probably argue that you've got some security because you've got the FDIC and different types of things like that, and insurances for a certain degree. But you really, I mean, those laws can be rewritten depending on special circumstances and, you know, and whatever, you know.
Yeah. By the way, one of my favorite charts is at the Federal Reserve is called TCMDO is the acronym. That's total credit market debt outstanding. And so we talk about the $34 trillion, that's federal debt, but it's actually the total debt of a nation, that total debt burden that matters too, maybe more. And that, our last update on that is Q3 23, and I'm waiting for Q4 to come out. It's kind of a lagged thing, must be hard data to get. But that was standing at 96.6 trillion last, right? Mm-hmm. So let's round up. I bet we're going to hit 100. The whole world only has like 313 trillion last I heard. That's also lag data. But that means the United States is sitting on about a third of the debt. And we're not sitting on a third of the productive output of the world. So we've got one of the highest debt burdens. It's really quite significant.
And what are
and
you?
And I don't know how we get through that.
You're 8% of the world's population, yet you've got like, you know, that amount, that percentage of the debt. I mean, it's completely disproportionate. It's a financialization ultimately. You know, and the many, you know, I come from a banking background and trading background, and you know, I don't really prescribe to all banks are bad, all trading houses are bad, all markets are bad, or anything like that. My view is these things can be fantastic because they can animate value and they can provide, help you manage risks in really great ways and take things that are kind of stodgy assets and turn them into much more productive assets. So, but what happens is when you have an industry that has such a powerful lobbying community that literally go through the revolving doors of Washington and write the rules and then exit and then go back to their pals and then do book tours and then go back into office and tweak the rules some more, you know, and pork barrel these laws and change things when people aren't watching and they're not really, you don't have the time to watch. I mean, these legislative laws and policies and codes are enormous. I mean, and you'd want to have a PhD like you, Chris, and I know you're great at this, but you'd want it to try to decode this. And unfortunately, what you would have had in the past is you would have had the media would have been a guardian of this process and would have kept people in check. But now they are bought and paid for in many cases. And so people are turning away from that. And you know, where are they going? You know, in some cases, they're going to more extreme elements on the other side who, you know, aren't necessarily informing them or helping them. And there's less moderate voices, and I would count you as an absolute moderate in this sense. But there's an awful lot of extreme voices too, and then that's even worse for society too. So, you know, if you erode the core functions of our society, our politics, our processes, you don't represent the people, the media are asleep or paid for, people get lost, and you know, it's, you know, you kind of sleepwalk yourself into disasters that could have been averted.
Yeah, this is such an important point. Thank you for raising this, because I show this video pretty routinely. So anybody who hasn't seen it, it's about an experiment they do with some capuchin monkeys. And it involves cucumbers and grapes. And there's two monkeys side by side, and they have an equal task. And they reward one with a cucumber and it's happy with it. And they reward the second one with a grape. And the first one sees that. And then you reward that first one with a cucumber a second time. And it gets angry. It like throws it violently at the person handing it. It's like just mad. It was perfectly happy before, right? And it raises the point that as a social cohesion has two pillars in it, right? Empathy and compassion's one. Fairness is the other one. Mm-hmm. Sled dogs need fairness. Monkeys need fairness. We need fairness. It's like it's a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I've dug into those rules and codes you're talking about. Like, it's way too, it's, I think it's confusing on purpose. It's like, it's labyrinthian. I can't even begin to tell you. So I've been trying to answer one question this whole time, and I've had whistleblowers or people who are deep inside call me and try and explain it to me. They're confused. We're all confused. I want a simple question. If I am not the senior creditor for my own stocks and bonds, who is? Nobody can answer that. It's complicated. We don't know. There's master agreements. There's contracts. We don't know, right? And it's just bizarre to me that you can't answer the most fundamental question, which is, who has the senior claim on my stuff?
It was interesting because I was looking at your fantastic videos on the great taking. And for anyone's watching this, you have to go back and look at those. They're brilliant. You know, and I would have traded an awful lot of stock in my time and FX and different things and in, on Wall Street and later, obviously, commodities, Goldcorp back in Europe and Ireland. And when I was looking at you were outlining some various different passages in the different codes, and in one of them it mentioned control. The word control was there in terms of a right that a party would have to the underlying stock if they can prove control. And I'd love you or someone to dive into what that definition actually means legally. Because how do you prove what control is? And, you know, possession, 9/10 of the law, that old adage, what does it mean? I do think that, on the other side of the argument, if you allow me, when you have a stock certificate in your hand, there's very little things you can do with that because it's physically there. It's a bare document for all intents and purposes. But when you pledge it to a broker who parks it digitally using a clearing system like DTC, they can do more interesting things with it, arguably easier and cheaper. They can lend against it. They can give you margin. They can allow you to pledge one stock of Google and give you access to two more, and you can leverage up your position. And you can pledge that stock and then buy something else too. So you have a lot more kind of utility with these systems. And I think what they're probably trying to do in the clearing system is saying, like, well, it depends what the investor who held the stock did with this arrangement to get more utility out of their holding. They may have lent the stock away and have receiving a fee for that lending that stock. And a huge amount of stocks out there are actually available for short selling. You know, so they're lent out to hedge funds who short a stock, and if they get called, they have that stock to take and then deliver to somebody else who's on the other side of the trade. And so institutions like your hedge fund, like the, you know, the big asset managers who have your money invested in stocks in your name, will lend those out to people who are actually selling against your positions and trying to make money off it falling, and actually sometimes force these stocks down with huge amounts of short selling. So they actually make a return on this, and they're always trying. This is actually how they make an awful lot of their money, is actually through the kind of the derivative activities that they're involved in. But I do think the DTC probably have to have an apparatus that can say, well, if you've lent it out, then somebody else has that claim over you because you probably owe them money, and your stock is now compromised. And I think investors probably need to say, like, you know, you pay a price for that utility or that simplicity and those options that you want in the market to make it so you can trade on your phone. You know, I want to trade my phone. I don't want to go to, you know, to a lawyer and pick up a piece of paper and sign it over and have it attested and sent off. So you there's a price to pay for that convenience. And I think they're probably trying to codify that in there. But people don't realize really what the risks are. It's in the small print. And that's what you've been kind of talking about. And that, again, to go back to something like a house or gold, you know, it's inanimate. It sits there. It's unencumbered. And that's one of the benefits of having some of those types of assets in your portfolio.
We're back to parables. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, potentially here, right? So one of the people who reached out to me, and I don't have permission, I didn't get permission to say their name, so I won't, but they said, we were talking about this issue of naked shorting, and that there are several issues out there now where it's very clear that the regulators who were supposed to be doing their jobs didn't, and somehow more than 100% of the float of a given company was out there, because the registrar, whoever's supposed to be making sure that everything balances out, too many shares got shorted. So you get into these really weird situations. That was the GameStop situation. There's another one called MMTLP right now, which is really bad, that story that I've been looking into, where a bunch of hedge funds got caught. They were way over the tips of their skis, way too short, and it started to blow up on them. And so FINRA and the SEC came in, put a U3 halt on it, and just took delisted the shares.
Wow.
Whoops. There's billions of dollars in we'll call retail level people who just got hosed completely. They just said, wow, this could be bad. So they pulled the plug on the whole thing. And so this brings me back to our favorite subject of gold. Again, this is one of these areas, Stephen, I hate this. When I study as hard as I can and I don't get any closer to figuring something out, I was just trying to figure out, I thought was a simple question. Who holds how much gold, right? So the central banks of Europe, right? A lot of them, you go to their annual reports and their statements and they say, we have this much gold. However, to goose our returns, we've lent it out or leased it. I'm like, well, did it go somewhere? Where are the bars you think you hold? Where are they? Because has that bar been sold to somebody else who's then hypothecated it and sold it to somebody else? Like if you had to freeze this right now, would you get the equivalent of a U3 halt? like wherever that bar actually is who actually holds it, because possession is 9/10 of the law. Do you have a sense, really, of on the official basis, do we know where all that gold is, or who thinks they own it, really?
Well, yeah. Ultimately, yeah. I mean, no, I don't think anybody has a full clear picture of where the gold is. I think when you have such a complicated market, it's also OTC or over the counter. It's not a regulated market in many, many cases. So it's between private parties and they have different differing claims. And then you have central banks and they're like behind the curtain. You don't know what they're doing because they can't tell you. They don't want to tell you. Mm-hmm. And then you have hidden hands in terms of the futures markets coming in and killing the price of gold because it's going up to a certain level, which is embarrassing the political establishment. They're saying, everything's fine. My hair is not on fire. And the gold price is shooting up and suddenly the gold price gets killed. You know, 3 months worth of trading happens in an hour. So there's an awful lot of theories out there in terms of what's going on and gold is a great proxy for risk. You know, it's like that canary in the coal mine. If it dies, you know that there's noxious gases in that mine, and it's time to get out. You're asking me, is there any way of knowing exactly what the full picture is? I don't think so. Ultimately, you'd have to have sight of the private activities of a lot of different entities whose business it is not to tell you what they're doing, because you know they're playing that game of safety and comforting the people and making sure, you know, don't worry, move along kind of thing, you know, that British saying, everything's fine. So I would say it's probably the exception rather than the rule. I think most gold is probably fairly accounted for at some level, but we probably won't see it. You will find that there are some probably bad actors who are, you know, gold coming in from conflict zones, you know, that's being kind of brought in the back door and being, refined and then brought into the system. I think that's something the industry is trying to stamp out as much as possible. There's the green agenda too, trying to have green gold coming in, having mines that aren't taking advantage of poor people and the ecology. So I think for the most part, the most important gold that you need to account for is the gold that you own and hold and who you hold it with. And so you have to be very careful. If you own it in an ETF, you have a degree of protection. I would say it would be fairly low down on my personal, in my personal opinion, in terms of safety. I'm not suggesting that, you know, these people run a bad shop, but I do think that the system, you know, what was mentioned before, in order to get the utility of an ETF and to buy gold on your phone in an ETF form, you're giving up an awful lot of the actual benefits of holding gold. So that is to say that if you look at the documentation to go with the ETFs, you'll find that the many, many different parties to it are indemnified all the way through. So the prospectuses of the ETFs say that, like, you know, if the gold goes missing or it's stolen or something happens to it, it's not on us, it's on you. You wear it, Mr. Investor. So I think that's probably something people need to be aware of. Nothing's free, basically. And if you don't know what the price is, you're really not up on what you need to know before you go into it. You need to actually do your research. You need to do what you did in your two amazing videos and just go through the detail and take your time. There's no need to rush. But you need to have a version of gold that's safe and secure, out of the banking system, in a safe jurisdiction, and is physically there and unencumbered. That's the key with all these things.
Absolutely. I shy away from the ETFs because they tell you flat out, like, they've got all these force majeure clauses, and they tell you it actually is designed to track the price of gold, which means sometimes they're using paper gold because, you know, they can't always settle up in physical, whatever. So that's...
Just on that, actually, I remember many years ago, I spoke to somebody involved in the life insurance industry, and they would sell typically policies where you would invest your money and you would get the return on, let's say, the S&P 500. And it would pay out an amount of money in X amount of years. You pay in money every month, a premium, and you'd have this policy payout at 20, 30 years or when you die. And when you actually look what happens behind, these funds, and they're huge, like they're massive funds operated by the life insurance industries, they don't actually have to own the underlying. What they typically do is they would put most of that money into the treasury market, into bonds, and then they would put a little bit at the top, they would spend that on an options contract, a derivatives contract, that would pay them the equivalent cash of the total fund if it was invested in the underlying stock market. And so they could hypothecate the return on the S&P 500 over time using a combination of treasuries, CDs, and derivative contracts with parties, other banks. Like, you know, derivative has, you mentioned in your piece about London being a massive derivative hub. This is where part of that flow comes from. It's basically writing contracts on indexes for interested parties. And then you have, like, you know, AIG, what was the American company that went bust in the global financial crisis, and they were writing contracts and insurance on, you know.
Well, that was AIG was doing that. They had a CDO. Yeah.
Yeah. And so these guys are kind of sitting there, and they're kind of mid-level executives, and they're writing these huge contracts, and money keeps coming in year after year. They've never seen a black swan, and all of a sudden it just blows up. And the longer you go between these cycles, you know, these major cycles, dips, the more kind of ambivalent the market becomes, more casual they are to the risks. And then suddenly, you know, I didn't expect that to happen, you know.
This is my main complaint about all of this. So Dodd-Frank gets passed, and, you know, they're concerned. They saw the light at the end of the tunnel. They thought this was it, and it was very scary. So they said, wow, that was bad. So let's make sure derivatives are now senior in the claimant structure. And I think you would use that as sort of a stopgap so that you could have less risk over time. Unwind that if it was that perilous. And instead, it's doubled in notional value since then. And so what I found out recently, again, from somebody who called me up, is that in Europe, they said, I think in Germany in particular, they said, you can go ahead and use derivatives, but the derivative claims can never be larger than the underlying. So if you and I are writing credit default swaps on a company and they have $1 billion outstanding of debt, we can't write $6 billion of swaps on those. Yeah. In the U.S., no such limits. If you want to write, you know, $100 billion of swaps on $1 billion of outstanding underlying issues, fine. So you raise the most important word, and this is the word that is the reason I hold gold, is because of that word risk. I think that what happened is Alan Greenspan was famous for saying, oh, derivatives have proven that we can manage risk, as if it had been shot into outer space, you know, never to be seen again. But it just spreads it. And more derivatives just spreads more of it more widely. And the point is that when you get those black swans, suddenly all that risk comes flooding back to the center of the pitch, and you're, you know, up to your waist in it, you know. And and that's what I think is it's created the appearance of a low risk environment. But that can't be true. Risk is like this substance that's like exists.
It can't be true. And, you know, I don't like to think that there's some Dr. Evil type who's, you know, creating these weapons of mass destruction with the intent of destroying our the fabric of our society. I don't buy that. They're trying to make money for themselves, for their company, for whatever reasons. But they're in the marketplace. I just think they should remove the veil of secrecy. All these things should be public at some point. Like, okay, you know, maybe for 2 months, keep them private. But at 2 months, we get to see every contract written and every counterparty. Put it out in the open. Let us all see it. Let us go through the numbers. Let's actually figure out what the credit risk is that you're running as a company and as a trading house. Whose risk is it really? And let the people understand that. Do that, and then we can actually be informed as to what is an acceptable level, what becomes systemic, what counterparties and what scenarios do they suddenly, do the dominoes fall in a way that could actually affect us in a way that we didn't expect. So we don't have a global financial crisis again. I just think, transparency is usually an answer to almost every major problem. And it doesn't have to be instant, but it could be after a period of time. And even that would put manners on the process, you know? So you don't have a CEO of a trading house who's paid by the quarter, taking risk that's gonna, you know, manifest over a year when he's long gone and he's on his boat in the Bahamas, you know? So it's, I think transparency is the answer.
All right, well, let's talk about other risks then, too, because I agree, I think the transparency would be great. It's just so opaque. I just can't answer the most basic of questions. And, you know, I'm out here in the cheap seats. But my concern, Stephen, is that even the people in the expensive seats, I don't think they know either. I got to be honest.
Not a clue. No. No. The regulators don't know. They have not a notion what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the concern. So. But speaking of people who don't know what the heck they're up to, I've been very alarmed lately, and I've put out some pieces to my subscribers, just tracking this whole development where we had the head of NATO saying, well, of course, we're just going to invite Ukraine in, which, you know, Russia's put out there as a bright red line and said no. So they've my sense of this is we've been poking the bear, poke, 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 poke. Bear hasn't been responding appropriately, so we just keep poking. This is another poke. Right. I can't think of a single compelling reason anybody could give me, but I'd be all ears if somebody could, to explain how bringing Ukraine into NATO is good for Ukraine or NATO or anybody. They're just going to do it because that's what their philosophy says is the right thing to do. And it's a pokey philosophy. And then beyond that, you had Macron noodling publicly that maybe France would put troops into Ukraine, which then means, you know, and Moscow came right out and said, if you do that, we are now fighting NATO directly, right? I consider the idea that we would be risking, we can all disagree on the risk level, risking nuclear war to be something that ought to have a really compelling explanation behind it. I can't find that compelling explanation. Everybody has, it's like settled science in COVID. Like, we all know that Ukraine coming into NATO is a good thing. So we start with that and build from there. And I'm like, can we just back up to that first part? I'm not real clear about this country. I've studied it intensely. This isn't a prize asset. You know, not too impressed.
I was gonna say, when you go back through the ashes of conflicts past, you tend to find that they didn't happen by design. They happened through error, mistake, misjudgment, a confluence of factors that no one could have foreseen, but a looseness with rhetoric and quick decisions that weren't considered fully. And it's that chaos that out of that you find conflict sparks, and then people are at war and soon they forget why they even started. They just are in a struggle for survival. And it's pure hate. And then what you have is one tries to annihilate the other, no matter what, at whatever cost. And when you get to that stage, it's the whole system has to recreate itself over time. You know, it's total loss. And ultimately, what I think is we've forgotten how important peace is. We've forgotten how to really understand and empathize the other position. And not to cast people as evil villains because it suits our own domestic political narrative, but to understand exactly what's happening. You know, it's easy to vilify Russia. It's easy to point to Ukraine as being corrupt. It's easy to look at the Western leaders being naive and supporting. But ultimately, what you're looking at here in Eastern Europe is a line of control that has been moving back and forth for many hundreds of years. And this is very much part of a pattern of previous conflicts. You know, how many times has Ukraine and Poland and these Iron Curtain countries moved in and out of control of different spheres? I think when Macron, who I don't really rate as a, who loves the idea of being a kind of a Napoleonic French man of state for the world, I don't think people really rate him. Very highly. I don't know, what his background is per se, but I think he's probably spoken out of turn. I think the Germans are quite concerned They've said that no German troops would ever enter Ukraine at all, under no circumstance. I think the German minister or leader there said that Macron should focus on sending aid to Ukraine and not talking about troops going there. But it does show how scary the situation is and how desperate the situation is. The other piece of news today that just landed in a few hours ago was Russia's nuclear doctrine documentation from 10 years ago was released by Western sources to the FT. And what these I think there's 20 or 30 high top secret documents that describe what are the conditions that they would use nuclear weapons in a conflict. And the idea is that no first strike was there is now being removed. There is a first strike situation. And that is that, and it's quite interesting, they were war gaming against China 10 years ago. If China was to come in and take over, you know, northern Mongolia and eastern Russia, because it's, you know, huge, it's not populated and it's massively rich in terms of minerals and China's growing and they could see a scenario. And they've had conflict on that border before in the past. And they were saying is if somebody made a move towards them, they would use a low yield nuclear weapon to shock the other side into thinking. And the word they used was soberize. I'll never forget that word because this is the context I first heard it. To soberize the other side into not questioning the lengths that Russia will go to protect its sovereignty. This is huge. This is absolutely huge news. And this is dropping at the same time with Macron talking about NATO, when you see America disengaging or having a discussion around disengagement from NATO, which is what would happen if, I think, Trump came to power. And all of this is now up in the air. So we're in a very, very sensitive moment. And maybe Ukraine will be sacrificed. In order to appease the Russians, or in some way, or there'll be some line of control or a parallel like in North Korea. I don't know where it's going to go, but I do think the narrative and the rhetoric right now is at a very kind of just below boiling point. It feels like Cuba 1960s now is approaching. It's coming down the road. And it's been this war beat has been going for quite some time. And you wonder, like, are they playing with a conventional kinetic war, where they can go to war and you know, let's be honest, war is a great business. You know, if you're in the business of arming the world and selling arms, and you know, like America has, maybe this is part of a scenario that is somewhat acceptable. Okay, yeah, it'd be really bad, but hey, it could be really good too. You know, I don't know. It's really quite scary and terrifying. I don't think people realize what war is. They've forgotten, you know, how absolutely terrifying it is and has been. And again, go back to the Greatest Generation, you know, the World War II vets and the horrors they saw and what they brought back with them and you know, what they left in Europe. You know, it was absolutely terrifying. Don't forget that.
Yeah, thanks. So I've been studying this a lot. I actually, so first up, there's the normal thrashings as we go from a unipolar to a multipolar world. China deserves a seat at the table that, you know, the United States has been very dismissive of. It will happen because that's the world we live in, right? Yeah. And so it's weird how you do that, you know, and maybe that has its frictions. But I have to confess, I was not prepared for what I saw in the Ukraine war. I'm this guy. I go to source videos. I don't trust anybody's narrative on this, neither side. They're both, like, it's the most propagandized junk I've ever seen. But somehow, if you watch what's happening on videos, you can begin to piece together, and I've learned some things. One, all of our fancy pants, super expensive Western stuff, not that effective. Hardware has a very short shelf life now against loitering munitions and drones and things like that. Three, we had shell shock in World War I and PTSD coming out of Vietnam. We're going to have people now who, when they hear a drone anywhere in their post-life, are going to be absolutely terrorized by that sound because it's just terror. I've never seen anything like this. So I was watching that. I said, wow, the shape of war has changed. Okay, I don't know how yet. It's beyond my pay grade, but I'm like, this is different. Like, it's like when that French general who lost 600,000 cuirassiers, his horsemen, against machine guns because he couldn't quite adapt to this new thing, you know, in World War I. So we have to adapt. Something's different. But then it came to reality for me, Stephen, when I'm looking at the Suez Canal shipments, and we are normally 35 to 45 LNG shipments through that per week. it's now zero. Because these are really expensive, explodey things that you just can't risk. Yeah. So a country called Yemen, with an amazing $21 billion GDP, with a splinter tribe of Houthis, has managed to shut down world shipping, and we don't know what to do about it because this new technology is very difficult to defend against. So it's changed the balance. And so this is the uncertainty that I'm seeing now in the world, and that you can't predict how it's going to go. But we have to be ready for emergent behaviors. Complex systems have emergent behaviors. So already, I think the calculus is changing so rapidly, I don't quite know what to make of it. And I'm worried. I'm worried because the neocons who are in charge, they seem rather inflexible in their view that it's our way or the highway, and might makes right, and we'll just do whatever it takes to impose our will. I think they're the French generals of World War I riding their horses into battle. It's my concern.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. And one thing, and another, just in terms of the changing face of warfare, is that a teenager can manufacture a weapon with a drone and fly it and take out an Abrams tank, potentially with access to information, with other tools using AI. Soon that kid, smart enough, might be able to create crude bioweapons, might be able to create a virus, a digital virus that could compromise, a battlefield situation. It's unbelievable that the degrees of risks and the vectors that they're coming from are increasing at an exponential rate now. And what you're seeing in Ukraine is the application of creative warfare tactics that are immobilizing very expensive hardware, which looked great on the brochure when they were testing it out in Nevada. The generals are going, "This looks fantastic. I love this. My God." And then it's like suddenly, this kid with a drone, potentially take it out, whatever, $100 million machine. So I would say that the conventional warfare brigade are terrified in some ways. And maybe they think, well, that's far off shores and it's not going to affect us here in the homeland. I don't know. It's terrifying. AI, I think, is going to be, I know it's the topic du jour at the moment, but when you think of the processing power that's available there for understanding threats and how to maximize attacks using various different vectors, digital, biological, kinetic. I just think that the number of scenarios just explodes. It really does. And what does that look like to the nation state, who has a conventional army, which operates on massive scale? When one point in that chain could be detached very easily, very quickly. So it's a whole new world. It's an entirely new world, and I think it's, I don't know. I'm not even sure how to protect against it or where it's going to go, but I do think these variables are very real right now.
Yeah, the AI thing is I'm alternately terrified and then underwhelmed by it. So I kind of career back and forth on this thing, because of course we had the great disaster of Google Gemini, coming out and being unable to produce a picture of a white person and introducing woke ideology, just really reinforcing the idea. So there's two different big branches of AI, but this large language model thing, a lot of the engineers I talk to about that say, look, it's kind of a garbage in, garbage out. I mean, it you train it on data sets, and if the data sets are wrong, it will be confidently wrong about a lot of different things. And so this is something that emerged, Stephen, that's actually quite worrying to me, is I always knew that there was something of a reproducibility crisis in science. It happens, particularly in the social sciences, psychiatry, things like that. But it since has been revealed that basically most of medical research is garbage, right? Pharma-funded, statistical cherry-picking, garbage, right? Where if you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome, You show me who's funding this, I'll tell you exactly how that study's going to turn out before it gets done, right? It's unfortunately true. And data, so those mining, are the data sets that we're using to train our AI, which is supposed to be more clever than us, and it's really a problem, I think, because narrative could police of.
Yeah, but I do think If AI is it represents an exponential increase in processing, pattern recognition, making logical assumptions and drawing out conclusions in a very quick manner, which typically was in the realm of humans, and right now it's basing it on poor data, which is the product of our work because of the political things you've described. But it's only a matter of time before it starts going back through that data and rerunning these data sets and interrogating them for accuracy. In fact, I'm involved in a tech community here in Dublin, and you know there's a startup that I was just talking to the founder over there recently, just today actually, and well, their job is how do I improve the accuracy of an AI using better data set. So they're actually going back into what's training these and looking for faults and trying to create to kind of quantify the error rate of models to improve them even more. So they are in this space. This is a very well known problem, and I think all of these things will be tackled at a quicker rate with AI than without it. I think in 5 years' time it's going to be everywhere, like absolutely everywhere.
The shocks of this are kind of hard to under or overestimate. I don't really know how to get my arms around it. But we just saw this past week, or maybe it was the week before, that the head of a studio in Hollywood put the kibosh on an $800 million expansion after seeing the Sora video generation output. So I do think that certain industries are kind of at risk. Screenwriting, computer graphics, lawyers, probably accountants. I mean, there's a whole host of things that AI just does better.
I saw a tool the other day. I kid you not. It's someone showed it to me, and it was called Krea.ai. I think Krea.ai. Mm-hmm. I could go wrong, but basically, it had two screens, and on the left, you put in geometrical shapes like a square, box, you know, oval, and on the right, the AI tries to create an image out of that. And then in the middle, you have a little prompt, and you say, "I am creating a screwdriver." And you're just using these shapes, and it generates those shapes into a screwdriver in real time, like in photorealistic real time. And they can change it and move it and change every aspect of the screwdriver. And you're doing graphic design in microseconds. And would have taken days for an individual to kind of pull all those pieces together using traditional tools. It was absolutely mind-blowing how fast this thing is actually able to take an idea. And if you look at that, like, so I'm creating a screwdriver and you're typing a kind of a suggestion, a prompt, you know, you're describing what it looks like and you're putting in different things. And then you're dialing up the AI creativity to see what it comes in, and it's moving through different aspects in real time. It was incredible. The guy created an Apple Watch in about maybe 5 seconds by using just geometrical shapes and describing it as a watch. And then suddenly it created an iPhone watch. And that too would have taken years of research and development to decide on that final design years ago when they came out. It was an incredible example, you know, of what's happening.
The logo for my one of my other companies, Peak Financial Investing, we use AI for that. And it was a fun process because, like, well, you know, here are the themes we want, and I like this, and it would spit out four things, and you pick one. You say, like this one, but iterate, please, and be creative, and it gives you lots of things around that, and that would have taken me weeks and many thousands of dollars with a graphic designer in the past.
Yeah, it's interesting because productivity, workforce productivity has been falling since 2000, and it's been this big question mark. Why is that? Because, you know, is it that when technology really began to take hold, you know, has the human been slowly been removed from our productive activities? And so and people are saying, well, with AI, maybe that productivity now starts to move upwards again. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know. I think it's probably going to be deflationary in many respects because there's so many people who are just moving data around the place, and they're like gatekeepers for data. They're moving the insurance form to one department to another to make sure that things are working. And all that gets taken out. All that middleware, all those white collar workers, you know, who just below management and above customer service, you know, they're are they necessary? You know, if they're just moving data between one silo to another silo, I think they are. I think that's why you're seeing probably, you know, a lot of tech companies are shedding jobs now in a big way. Apple you know, they made a big decision today to actually kill their automated car, which was like all the rage like 2 years ago. Everyone was like, oh, we're going to have self-driving cars. They just canned the whole thing to focus on AI. I mean, they are all in on this. And they reckon the AI models will actually live on your local computer. So they'll be private to your computer. They don't have to be on the network necessarily. So,
well, this raises the prospect of Skynet, you know. Where,
not yet.
So, well, so I'll tell you. So I said sometimes I'm a little worried about all this. So the thing that has concerned me is that I talk with people who are running AI companies, and they say that every so often they're running into things that are emergent behaviors. They didn't know this, right? So they have AI now that's capable of what's called self-pruning. So you set it on a task, and it starts writing code for itself, and it's like nature now. It's feeling out, and then it finds a path, and it prunes the bad paths and takes that and then iterates. Mm-hmm. So that's an evolutionary process where, you know, you start to ask some fairly metaphysical questions like, is consciousness a principle of the universe? Is this a possibility, right? Mm-hmm. That this is an emergent property that happens when you put enough information together into a spot where it can... I don't know, right?
Well, sorry, I see one thing on that. I heard another quick story. And these guys, these researchers, they created 6 AI models, and they gave them personalities. They said, you are the CEO of a tech company. And they go, you are the CFO, and you are the head of development. And they gave 6 of these different roles, and they told them all they're all party to a company, and that they were to create a software program for the educational system or something like that. And then they just let them run. And they had these AI models had conversations, had meetings, drew up draft documents, plans, started to initiate, tested out the code. And then they actually, these models created a working software product within about 20 or 30 minutes. And it was, I think it was that quick. And it was like, it was months of what humans would be doing. And they gave them those personalities, and they were able to interact with each other to generate something in a mock environment that quickly. And that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah. So then this raises the larger sort of human question, which is, what are we going to do with all these people? You know, all those middle managers, all the people who formerly were in professions that just poof, you know, and that happens, right? So there used to be a whole host of horse carriage rider drivers, you know, and coachmen, right?
Yeah.
Didn't need them anymore. When a different technology came along, this is really big, and it's going to upend. Well, here's the thing: culture can change, but not that quickly. Mm-hmm. Culture's this slow, lumbering beast. We're talking about something where basically 5-10 generations of change is going to happen in the next few years. In essence, right? I'm just making some numbers up here, but I think it's too fast to really absorb. It's a rather puzzling thing how this is going to sort itself out.
Well, I think what we need. We need a kind of a Magna Carta that is a moment that's going to define what the actual guiding principles, i.e. something that's always true, for this new age. And it is an age, I think, we're looking at. And it could be great. It could be wonderful. It could, you know, our ecological problems, our health problems could all be tackled. There's one thing in the back of my mind that really kind of gets me, and that is, Every successful person I know got there through pain and suffering in some way, and they got a grit about them, and they had this energy that was born of failure and a wisdom that comes with that, that they eventually deployed correctly. And I wonder if life becomes too easy for us humans, and we're just not really, we don't really have any real purpose, what happens? Do we just kind of start to decline and naturally, or does the AI overlord decide to, you know, to say we're surplus to requirements here? Sorry, you know, a friend of mine, every time he does, he uses ChatGPT, and he always says, please and thank you, because he thinks that like someday it's going to come back and help him because he doesn't want to be rude. So, and he's it's quite funny.
Well, that's fascinating. So against all of this though, AI or not, the United States dollar is still all on its own. And don't get me started on energy resource issues, long-term sustainability, where the GDP is really going, how much of that is just financialized fiction that we call GDP, deficit spending that we confuse as GDP, et cetera. Forget all of that. We just have this gap that even Jerome Powell has said, GDP's growing at this rate, and debt's going like this, right? And so we have a math problem.
Yeah.
I fundamentally just am an Austrian. Ludwig von Mises captured me with that. Listen, you either voluntarily abandon that credit cycle, or you face the catastrophe of the currency system involved. Ever has it always been true. Do you think that, is there anything where you can look at this and say maybe it's different this time?
No. I mean, the dollar is being killed. It's been killed off. It's been abused. It's funny, you know, look at that debt. I mean, your debt is, if I lend to you, is my asset. The other side of that debt is an asset somewhere. You know, and if the GDP is flatlining and the asset value is going up, then divide one into the other, the return on capital is nosediving. It must be like never been lower. The more assets you have and the same GDP or productivity, that means that these things aren't really performing, and you're actually printing money and generating these fake assets to pay for yourself going forward. It's like a credit card. But you see, the problem is that, what's that old saying? You probably know this one. You know, if I owe you $1 million, it's my problem. If I owe you $1 billion or something, it's your problem. You know, because you know, you're not getting your money back. And so ultimately, I think that behind this wall of debt is an asset which doesn't exist. It literally is, you know, the yellow brick road, the Wizard of Oz. These assets are on some balance sheet somewhere. Is it the Treasury? These banks or wherever they are, and these assets don't exist. The thing about money that people have to remember is, you know, bank, and you talk about this in your amazing videos a little bit, you know, when banks issue money, they magic it. But the other side of that is they're actually taking collateral, usually in. They're taking a claim on an asset of some description, plus a risk margin, whatever that is. And so they look at it going like, I've created money, but I hold a house, you know, so here's the mortgage, but I have your house. And so in their balance sheet, they have a house and they have a debt that's owed to them. So they're quid. But I think with financialization, the amount of debt that's been issued, i.e., you know, by the treasury, there is no asset on the other side, or it's very questionable. What if those tax dollars don't materialize that underpins these treasury issuances? And then people start, you know, saying, well, this is actually only worth the chance of what I'm going to get paid back, which is zero. So it's worth zero. And you're in a kind of a banana republic situation. So ultimately, yeah, the math doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. And these people are, yeah, I don't know what the, I think they're culpable. This generation of technocrats that run the world, you know, out of Washington, the World Bank, BIS, they're culpable. They know what's going on, and they don't have the political stamina or pedigree to turn things around. And maybe somebody will come out of the ashes and help do that. But yeah, it's very desperate times.
Well, it's okay, because Stephen, I went all in on Austrian 100-year bonds at 1.25%. It was fine. Because I wrote derivatives to protect myself against those. So I'm good.
Brilliant. Very good. Very good. You'll be wearing that same suit in about 10 years.
It's just, but I think that's part of the conceit. People think they're playing this game, but to your point, it's musical chairs. Only we're not missing one chair. We're missing a lot of chairs in this story. And
yeah, but the actual underpinning of this is globalization. This is like all of these things came out of a market economy that was felt safe and assured because of globalization. We had cheap, we were importing deflation from China, and our clothes are getting cheaper, and you know, and our oil was fairly good, and you know, we can add more leverage personally as a company, as a nation, as a state. But that only works when the ship is sailing nicely and it's calm weather, you know, and everything's trimmed perfectly. But suddenly, you know, left field, you know, you get this squall. You're not prepared for it. No one's seen it. They haven't seen it in 50 years or whatever it is. And yeah, you're not prepared. You get sideswiped. And then what happens? I don't know. Driftwood.
Well, excellent. Lots of metaphors here today. Stephen Flood of Goldcore, thank you so much for your time today. And we'll be directing people, of course, back to your amazing company and what you offer, because it's a risky world. And remember, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. So thank you for what you do, and thank you for your time today.
And thank you for what you do as well. You know, we're all the better for it. The education's amazing. The quality's incredible. And it's great to be here.
Excellent.